MechCast, Wednesday, October 23rd, 2013. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, we got a big show for you this week because it was a big week for Apple. Apple held their October special event announcing, as many of us thought they would, some new iPads. They called it their We Still Have a Lot to Cover event, and yep, they had a ton of stuff to cover. It wasn't just iPads, but also some new Macs in terms of MacBook Pros, as well as details on the Mac Pro. We had a preview of that at WWDC, but we've got a little more details now. And all I have to say is I think that Apple is going to have a huge, huge holiday quarter. I think they're doing their current quarterly results or their last quarterly results call on the 28th. We'll see how those numbers come out, but everybody's expecting them to be pretty positive. But the last quarter of this year is going to be massive. I think Apple calls that their first quarter of 2014 when they actually announce those results. And at the end of that, I think all of our bank accounts are going to be a lot emptier, at least if you're like me and want to buy all this stuff. But the cool thing is that after that, we'll have some awesome new products to play around with. So we're going to talk about those products in this episode. I'm also going to dive into some of the aftermath, some of the tips and tricks and additional information that we're finding out now that everything's over and just a little bit of the reality distortion field is worn off. I think it's still floating around there. So it's going to be a few weeks, and it's going to be until we can actually get these things in our hands and play around with them that we're going to have some of the hardware questions answered. Apple also, I almost forgot, another huge announcement, the release of OS X Mavericks. And so a lot of people are getting that in their hands because that is available now, and it's pretty easy to get. Again, I don't want to give too much stuff away. You probably already know, but people are downloading Mavericks in droves, and we're starting to get details on how that's working, as well as updates to the iLife and iWork applications. So I've got tips and tricks for that, all kinds of good information in this episode, some feedback from you that I got via Twitter. People are discovering stuff. It should be a great, great show. I look forward to bringing it to you. But before we dive into it, I do need to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Transporter by Connected Data. You know, the cloud, iCloud, cloud storage, these are hot topics these days, and it's because so many of us, our Macs are connected, we have iPads, we have iPhones, we're connected all the time, but a lot of our devices have limited storage. So the cloud solves a really great problem. It gets us access to more data, more information, our documents when we're connected, but maybe don't want to have all that stuff synced over or stored on our actual devices. But the thing is there might be some data that you want to access via the cloud, but you don't like the idea of having copies up in someone's server. So many of these things require a service, and you have to put your files in someone else's trust. It might be data that is just too sensitive. You don't want to put up there, but you still want to have access to it. And that's where the Transporter comes in. It really combines that cloud access, but with the privacy and security of a personal hard drive or a network attached storage device of a NAS. And it's more than that because it also gives you a lot of the functionality of some of the services like Dropbox. Dropbox-like features like the ability to sync your files or also easily share them just using links. So generating a link and sharing that out to someone so that they can download a file. And the setup process is also super simple. Basically, the way it works, Transporter is a hardware product. It's a hard drive, network attached. You basically go on the site, you purchase your Transporter, you can choose between 1 terabyte or 2 terabyte models. There's also a Transporter that you can get to add your own 2.5-inch hard drive. So there's a 2.5-inch hard drive in there. And then when you get it home to set it up, you simply plug it in, plug in the transporter, connect it to your network, the Ethernet, or you can get a Wi-Fi adapter that hooks up to a little USB port on the device. And then on your Mac, you run the transporter software, and it will automatically recognize your new transporter, walk you through the setup, get you an account on connected data, and let you set up all your folders and how you want to share things, and you're ready to go. And once it's set up, then you can securely and privately share your files with other transporters or other computers, even with users who don't own transporters. They can get a transporter account, and you can share your files and data directly to their computers. But the key is that it's from transporter to their computer. There's no server out in the cloud involved. Your files are always in your control. They're on the computers and devices and on the transporters that you're aware of and you know that you're sharing with. And they just released version 2.0 of the Transporter iOS app, which means that you have great mobile access, direct access to the files and information stored on your transporter. So that gives you that connectivity, that remote connectivity that a cloud service does, but you're going directly back to your transporter. And version 2 also adds some great features like the ability to upload full resolution photos and videos right to your transporter. So that means you can shoot a bunch of photos and videos. If your iPhone's filling up, you can upload those to your transporter, send them directly there, and then free up the valuable space on your device. And when you get home, guess what? Your transporter's connected. If you're syncing, they're there on your Mac, and you can throw them into iPhoto, do whatever you want with them. So it's great because the transporter is your server. It is your cloud storage. You don't have to have a computer on. You don't have to have monthly fees associated with the service. You buy the transporter and you're done. It is the cloud service. You can learn more about Transporter by going to filetransporter.com/Maccast. And here's a great deal. Because you're a Maccast listener, you can get $50 off your transporter purchase from filetransporterstore.com. So when you go to buy your transporter, go to filetransporterstore.com, select the unit you want, and at checkout, use the discount code MC50. MC50, all in uppercase, and you'll get $50 off. So it's even more affordable to get your own personal cloud storage device. It's a great deal and a great product. Check it out, filetransporter.com/Maccast, and a big thank you to Connected Data and Transporter for their support of the Maccast. So let's talk about Apple's huge "we still have a lot to cover" event. It played out as typically these events do, with Tim Cook coming out, kicking things off, talking about how Apple's been doing, talking about some of the products that Apple's already released. The new iPhones, we know those did really well. He reiterated that they sold 9 million iPhones in that opening weekend. He also talked about the success of iOS 7 and how quickly devices were being updated and people were adopting the new OS. He said nearly two-thirds of iOS devices are now running iOS, 200 million devices. And that's a big, big number. iOS 7 has been hugely successful. He also talked a little bit about iTunes and the new iTunes Radio service. I love iTunes Radio. I don't know if you've been playing around with it, but I've been using it quite frequently. It had a little hiccup for me last week, but beyond that, it's been running pretty smoothly. I've been able to set up some great stations, and I really enjoy listening to it. And I guess a lot of people do as well, because Cook said 20 million people have listened to over a billion songs in just the last month in the U.S., and I think Apple wants to quickly roll out the service to other countries. Of course, they've got to do all kinds of deals and things like that, and it takes time. So I think we're going to be on that sort of progression like we were with TV shows and movies. It's going to take a while to sort of roll it out to other countries. But those of you who have it and who have been enjoying it, seems like it's going very well. He also talked about apps and how successful the app and the App Store has been. 60 billion downloads. They've doled out $13 billion to developers. So healthy ecosystem there. The one thing early on in the presentation that was a little bit odd was Cook was kind of stumbling in a few places, and the whole vibe of the thing seemed a little weird, at least in the first half. It kind of smoothed out in the second half. There were a couple little sketches or kind of skits that they went through that felt a little bit forced and awkward. So maybe not the most pristine keynote that Apple's ever given, but I thought it was pretty good overall. And I just didn't know if maybe they were rehearsing too much, or I thought actually my thought was maybe there's just so much stuff that they were doing into the buildup, they just didn't have as much time to kind of prepare for this keynote. I don't really know, but I talked to a couple other people after the event, and a lot of us got the same kind of impression that there was just some odd moments in this one. It is up and available on Apple's website, also in the keynote podcast, as well as on the Apple TV. So if you haven't seen it, you can go watch the full thing. I think it's about an hour and a half or so. The whole front hour, Apple was able to hold off on saying anything about iPads, so they left kind of the thing everybody was waiting for till the end, which they typically do. And it was great. It was absolutely awesome. And we're going to get into all those iPads. But I want to kind of follow the flow that Apple used for the keynote. So they kicked things off in terms of announcements with OS X Mavericks. A lot of the stuff we already knew about. They reiterated the fact that they were focusing kind of on the three main areas in Mavericks: technology, features, and apps. Under the technology heading, the big deal with OS X Mavericks is there's a lot of under-the-hood stuff to give you better performance, longer battery life, those sorts of things. They highlighted the compressed memory, which we've talked about on the MacCast, which allows you to allows the operating system to do more with less memory. It can instantly compress inactive parts of the memory down, so you can fit 6 gigabytes of data, for example, in just 4 gigabytes of RAM. So if you have less RAM in your system, you're going to be able to do more. I still am of the opinion that more physical RAM is one of the best upgrades you can do for your system. So I'm still going to put a lot of RAM in my systems, but this should help in those sort of memory crunched situations. The graphics were also highlighted. Mavericks can now dynamically allocate more or less memory to integrated GPUs, and they can do that on the fly as needed. So no more locking up a specific amount of memory in those integrated processors. That's a big deal for some of the new machines. Integrated graphics also has support, full support for the new OpenCL standards, and you can run tasks and things a lot faster, running CPU tasks, some of the CPU stuff on the GPU using the OpenCL technology if that's built into your application. So it's just things are going to get a lot faster. They highlighted some new software features in terms of Safari, specifically integration for Twitter and LinkedIn. There's a new view for the reader. Technologies in the Finder, something I'm very excited about, is Finder tagging. So you can now tag your documents and files. You can do that in the open file save dialog boxes. It syncs with iCloud. It's going to make using Spotlight searches and smart folders based on tags a lot more useful. And I'm looking forward to using that stuff. Another big thing that I've never been a huge fan of notifications on OS X, but something that Mavericks is bringing is these enhanced notifications where they can be interactive. Specifically, one I'm excited about is iMessages. So when you get a message notification, you can now actually respond to the iMessage. You get a little dialog box to do a reply right inside the notification window. That means I don't have to open up iMessage on my Mac, which I don't open all that frequently. I'm usually doing iMessage on my iOS devices. So when I'm at my desktop, it's going to be really nice to just hover over the notification, fill in a quick reply, and respond to that all without having to open my app. So I'm looking forward to that. So there's a lot of cool technologies in there. Another one I'm super excited about that they showed off a little bit more, talked a little bit more about, is better support for multi-screen displays and being able to have full-screen apps on multiple monitors, two different applications at the same time. Yes, can you believe it? This should have been there from the very, very beginning. But I'm excited to play around with that. Also, you get the dock on all of your screens. I guess that's a little bit non-intuitive at first. John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer commented on this. But apparently, if you don't see the dock on your second monitor, so it comes up on your primary monitor, if you're working over on your second monitor and you want to get access to the dock, you just have to drag your cursor down near the bottom where the dock would normally be, and I guess it will fade out of the one system or pop down on the one screen and pop up on the other screen. So kind of like a rabbit. I haven't seen the animation myself yet because I haven't had a chance even to install Mavericks yet. I've been too busy just reading about it and trying to cover it. I do have it on a test system, but haven't done the upgrade on my main machine yet, which is the one where I have multiple monitors. So that's really cool. You also get menu bars for each application on the monitor where you're running those apps on. So your menu bars are going to be on both screens, which means you're not going to have to do a lot of flipping back and forth. And also AirPlay will now allow you to AirPlay do an extended desktop. So you can use an AirPlay device as a second screen. So an Apple TV or a third screen, even if you already have dual monitors. The one thing I've read now about the multi-display support is that some USB DisplayLink screens, these are the monitors that you can hook up using DisplayLink and a USB port, some of them are reportedly having some issues, some display issues where it's getting graphic artifacts or you're getting tearing or all those kind of weird things that can happen with monitors. And it does seem to be a driver issue that was acknowledged by DisplayLink. They're reportedly working on a fix. So I don't know if that'll have to come from Apple or DisplayLink. But if you have one of those monitors and have been experiencing issues after upgrading, that's what's going on. A couple great new applications that Apple is adding to Mavericks, Maps and iBooks. They look beautiful. Craig Federighi talking about some of those mistakes. He mentioned being able to do turn-by-turn directions on your Mac, but quickly changed it to driving directions, which is what he initially meant to say, because I think most of us don't have a Mac in our car, so turn-by-turn doesn't make all that much sense. But Maps look beautiful. I'm looking forward to the ability to send map directions right to your iPhone. That's another cool new feature, right to an iOS device, so you can look up something on your Mac and then shoot that over to your iOS device when you're on your way out the door. And then the big bombshell that they dropped is, because we were all wondering about when is it going to be available and what is the price? Well, the price is free. And that goes back all the way even to Snow Leopard users. So those of you who didn't upgrade, have been holding off, didn't want to pay for Lion, didn't want to pay for Mountain Lion, you can now get OS X Mavericks completely free. You can do a direct upgrade from Snow Leopard to Mavericks. You do need to have Snow Leopard because you got to get it through the Mac App Store. The Server Edition is still an additional purchase at $19.99 US. So if you're running Server, you are going to have to drop down the $20 to get the Server option. I think if you already have it, though, I didn't read about it. If you already have the Server version, I'd be curious to know if you can just do a straight upgrade, if it's just an update to OS X Server, or if you actually have to buy a whole new version to run on top of OS X Mavericks, because it is an add-on. You got to buy the OS X Mavericks and then add on the Server piece. So if you are running that, let me know how that process worked for you. And because it's free, it looks like a lot of you are downloading and using Mavericks. We're already getting some initial numbers on potential adoption rates. Now, it's coming from a web analytics company called Go Squared. They reported that they saw Mavericks web traffic go up on the 40,000 plus sites that they monitor, go up over 7% in just 24 hours. So that seems to indicate a lot of people are downloading and upgrading to OS X Mavericks. The install process, as near as I can tell, looks really, really smooth. I'm seeing very few reports of any issues in transitioning. I'm saying that with a caveat. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about some of my recommendations and just recommendations from the community in terms of upgrading to any brand new OS. I'll give you a spoiler here. Be careful, right? We don't all need to rush out to update. We'll talk more on that in a minute. But I want to get to some of the new hardware products. So they start out with Mavericks, and it was available that day to download. Turns out a lot of stuff that was available launch day, including some new hardware, so new Mac Pros. Major updates to both the 13-inch and 15-inch Retina MacBook Pros. They started out with the 13-inch. It is now under 3.5 pounds, a little bit thinner at 0.71 inches, and was updated with the new Haswell technology. So it's got a Haswell chip, the new Iris Intel integrated graphics, running it up to 90% faster, and it is a fourth generation dual core chip, has up to 9 hours of battery life. I think some of that coming into play because of the better efficiency with OS X Mavericks, but better battery life on the new Retina 13-inch MacBook Pro. Faster PCIe-based flash storage, 802.11ac Wi-Fi, Thunderbolt 2. The flash is actually 60% faster, so you're going to have faster read-writes and things like that. And Apple announced they're dropping the price on the base model. It's down $200 from before, starting at $1,299. And that is shipping right now, so you can go buy one. I was on the Cult of Max Cultcast, though, and Irfan there, the host of that show, pointed out that one big change is on that base 13-inch model, the one that's $200 cheaper, they no longer have a dedicated graphics chip. So you're not going to get the GeForce chip in that model anymore. It just comes with the Intel Iris graphics. But the Iris graphics are supposed to be a huge improvement over the last generation. And because Mavericks is doing things like the dynamic integrated memory thing, so it's not having to lock up a certain portion of your RAM, I think the trade-off is probably fair. We'll have to see how the benchmarks work out and how the new Intel chip is performing, but I think we've seen that on the PC side, and it's a pretty smoking graphics chip, so I think it'll do pretty well for most people. If you do want a discrete graphics chip, you're going to have to probably jump up to the higher-level model or go with the 15-inch MacBook Pro, which was also updated. It's using, actually, a Crystal Well chip. I hadn't heard about the Crystal Well before, but I guess that's basically the Haswell chip, but in a quad-core configuration. It also has the Iris Pro graphics, but you can add a discrete GeForce 750M processor in the 15-inch models. So that one has up to 8 hours of battery life, PCIe flash storage, so the faster flash, 802.11ac, Thunderbolt 2, and its price was also dropped down $200 to starting at $19.99. That's down from $21.99 US in the prior generation model. That is for a 2.0 gigahertz i7 Crystal Well chip, 8 gigs of RAM, and a 256 gigabyte SSD. And that is also available in shipping right now. We're starting to see some early benchmarks show up on the new MacBook Pros, and they're showing about a 4 to 10% higher Geekbench score than the previous generation models. So that pretty much falls in line with what we would expect with a bump up in the processor technology. Battery life, though, is looking to be longer according to some of the reports that I've been seeing. So you may get a little better battery life than what Apple's actually advertising, which is a little bit of a flip from what we normally see, although Apple very often sort of underestimates the battery life on their devices. Of course, battery life always comes down to usage as well. But those are the new MacBook Pros. I am super excited about them. I'm having to try really hard not to go on Apple's website and buy one or not rush down to my Apple retail store. I really would love a new Retina MacBook Pro. I have a 2011 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I love it. There's nothing wrong with it. I don't need to replace it. It's fast. It does everything I need it to do, so I have no excuse for going out to buy one other than it'd be really nice to have the Retina screen. And I know that once I have the Retina screen, I can't go back, so I'm better off probably just sticking with what I have for another year or two. I try and keep my Macs for at least 4 or 5 years if I possibly can, and this one seems to be running just fine. So Mavericks, I think, is going to give everybody a little bit of a refresh. That's one thing that I'm excited about. If your machine will run Mavericks, and I guess I probably should have mentioned the models that run Mavericks. We've talked about it on prior MacCasts, but Apple did reiterate, pretty much if your machine runs Mountain Lion now, you should be able to run Mavericks. So if you qualify for Mountain Lion, you can run Mavericks. You need a 64-bit Intel processor, a more modern graphics card. But, you know, it was like 2007 iMacs and newer. They have a list on Apple's website. It's amazing, actually, how far back it goes. And you'll get the benefits of some of that new technology. So your laptop might suddenly get a little bit better battery life just by upgrading your operating system. It might run a little bit faster, even with less memory, just by getting Mavericks. So I think Mavericks is a worthwhile upgrade for anybody who can run it. I think it's going to be a smooth-running operating system. It's kind of, you know, just a next iteration. So Lion was a little rough, Mountain Lion a little less rough. I think they've really refined it. We're kind of onto that third generation from some major new features, and I think it's going pretty smoothly. But again, that little warning, not everyone should be upgrading, and I'll tell you who I think shouldn't be upgrading here in a moment. But let's talk more hardware. Let's talk about the Mac Pro. Mac Pro details we finally have. They are going to come in 4, 6, 8, or 12-core configurations. They're using the Intel Xeon E5 processors, super fast DDR3 ECC memory running at 1,866 megahertz. You'll be able to configure your Mac Pro with 16 gigabytes, 32 gigabytes, or up to 64 gigabytes of RAM. We know it was going to have those dual AMD Fire Pro GPUs, different amounts of memory depending upon the configuration, but I think they start at 2 gigabytes of memory in those in those graphics chips. So these things are going to be smoking. You got up to half a terabyte of bandwidth in the bus. The things will run at up to 7 teraflops, according to Phil Schiller. So there's no doubt these things are going to be screamers. Flash storage starts at 256 gigabytes. You can also get 512 or up to 1 terabyte of storage. 6 Thunderbolt 2 ports. That's a lot of expansion. All the expansion is external. You're not going to be able to add anything in there. There's no room for extra storage. So you're going to get the unit configured the way you want it, and then use breakout boxes, which I'm sure there's going to be a ton of innovative products from various companies for adding graphics cards, for adding RAID storage, all sorts of thing. And those Thunderbolt ports are going to be able to keep up. 20 gigabits per second throughput. You can do channel bonding. You can have 6 devices per port. So what's that? 36 devices if you're chaining things together. That's a lot of expansion. It might look like a spaghetti mess, as some people are predicting. But again, I talked about this a little bit on the Coldcast. I really think that third-party developers of peripherals are going to come out with some really innovative Thunderbolt 2 Mac Pro targeted products. So I imagine really cool expansion chassis where you've got a little area that the Mac Pro just fits into, and it looks like it's integrated into the device, turning it into almost a single unit. I think you can do some really creative stuff, and I fully expect companies to do that. Additional expansion on the Mac Pro, 4 USB 3 ports, dual gigabit Ethernet, HDMI 1.4 Ultra HD, so you can have up to three 4K displays connected to this thing, plus an HDMI display, an HDMI monitor. So for video editors, I think this is going to be a dream machine. One odd thing, though, with all of that technology, and I'm going to tell you the price tag in a moment, you don't get a mouse and keyboard. So it's BYO, mouse and keyboard. I don't know why Apple couldn't just throw one in. It seems like it, especially at this pricing. Pricing was actually a little bit lower than I thought it was going to start at. I had predicted, I think, and I think I mentioned this on a couple of MacCasts, that I thought pricing was going to start around $3,499 US. Apple actually has the base model priced at $2,999. For that, you get a 3.7 gigahertz quad-core Intel Xeon E5, 12 gigs of RAM, the Dual Fire Pro D300 graphics chips, and a 256 gigabyte flash storage. If you want to jump up to the next model that Apple has announced, it's $3,999 US, and for that you get a 3.5 gigahertz 6-core Intel Xeon processor, dual AMD Fire Pro D500 graphics processors. Those have 3 gigabytes of RAM each and 256 gigabytes of flash storage. And Apple will have the Mac Pros available before the end of the year. Right now, those are the only two configurations that they're giving pricing or any information on. We know they're going to have 8 and 12 core editions of this thing. No pricing on that. So I'm assuming those are add-on build-to-order options, and we don't have any details on any of the build-to-order stuff right now. But, you know, you can expect that a fully decked-out machine, you're going to be in the tens of thousands of dollars. If you just max out everything, you are going to be paying a pretty penny. But pros like those things. They have those big, beefy machines, and they will use them. So I'd be curious to know from any pro users out there, are you going with a Mac Pro? Are you going to go iMac? Are you going with MacBook Pros? What's your thought on this? I think these things look great. It'll be interesting to see how well they're received by the pro community. From a few of the pro people that I've talked to, I know people are going to be buying them, and they're pretty excited about them. So I think it's going to do very well. It's certainly a niche segment for Apple at this point, but I'm excited to see what happens with it. And also, Apple did a great video that shows how these things are built, and they're being built and assembled in the U.S., I guess I should say. They made a point of mentioning that it's going to take 2,000 people all over 20 states to help build this thing. I'm assuming that's not just Apple employees. It's probably some of Apple's partners and people building various components also in the U.S. So some of the components are coming from the U.S. I think a lot of it's coming from overseas. But the final assembly is going to be at a factory here, at plants and facilities here in the U.S. So that's pretty exciting to see Apple bringing at least some manufacturing back to the U.S. I think we're going to see some critical reports of it saying, well, Apple's not hiring that many people. If you watch the video, you'll see there's a lot of robots involved in the assembly process. It's just sort of the final assembly, the last stages before it goes into that box where humans come into play. So it'll be interesting to get the actual numbers on how many people Apple's employing to assemble Mac Pros in the U.S., but I expect the number to be relatively small in comparison to the overall workforce. That's not going to be shocking or surprising, but I will tell you, at the end of that video, they show the little laser thing etching into the back of the Mac Pro or wherever it is on the Mac Pro. I'm not sure exactly where the Apple stuff is, but you know, you have the Apple logo and then it etches in the designed by Apple in California. And then in the last part of the video, it etches in assembled in the USA. And I have to admit, I got a little choked up when I saw that video. It's a pretty powerful, if you're from the States, it's a pretty big deal that we're bringing this manufacturing back in here, even if it's small. You got to start somewhere, and I'm proud that Apple is doing that, and some other companies are too. I mean, Motorola should get some credit. The new Moto X is assembled in the U.S., that customized thing, and they fired that up a few months ago. So I think it's a trend where we're going to see tech companies bringing more manufacturing back into the United States. And, you know, it'll build. Hopefully it'll build and the trend will continue. And hopefully it's very successful. So we'll just have to see on that. But that's the new Mac Pros. Then they came in and they talked about the new apps. And there were some significant new app updates. Eddie Q took on that portion of the keynote. That had a weird moment where they got into some of the new collaboration features in iWork and Pages, and that's a big new deal. And they did this little back and forth. That whole part of the presentation for me was a little bit slow. It drug a little bit. I think they could have pushed through that a little bit faster. But here's what we're getting with the new apps. iLife was completely updated, both on iOS and on Mac OS X for Mavericks. Also, iWork updated. So you've got new iMovie, new iPhoto, GarageBand for iOS and Mac. You've got new Pages, Keynote, and Numbers for iOS and Mac. The big deal here is that they're all 64-bit and integrated with iCloud. And a huge statement that Apple made is that with the iWork applications, they've got feature parity across all the platforms. So that means web, desktop, and iOS are going to support all of the same features according to Apple. So let's talk real quickly about iLife. iPhoto is now faster and smoother. It's got a new look in iOS to match the iOS look, and they're bringing photo books to iOS on the iPad. So we know that Apple's been sort of, they got rid of the iCards app, but a lot of people really like photo books, so you'll be able to do those on your iPad in the new version of iPhoto. New version of iMovie was also completely redesigned for iOS. It's more focused on editing and sharing, brings some really cool new features. I'll give you some more details on those, but briefly, picture-in-picture and speed controls. Also, it was redesigned on the Mac, so you're going to get a new look and feel on the Mac. Also, new icons you'll see in the applications, and they added a new feature called iMovie Theater, which lets you view your movies right inside iMovie and across your devices. GarageBand also got a refresh, an all-new look in iOS 7. iOS will now support 16 tracks, and if you have a 64-bit device, you'll be able to do 32 tracks on a 64-bit iOS device with GarageBand. And there's also a new look on the desktop, and they added a bunch of new features, including a new drummer feature that'll allow you to assemble and create better drum tracks inside GarageBand. I have a major complaint about GarageBand that I'll tell you about a little bit later. And big deal here too, free seemed to be the word of the day, because the iLife updates are all free for existing owners and also free with the purchase of any new Mac or iOS device, and they are available now, so you should be seeing and getting those updates if you're an owner of the iLife suite. Same kind of thing on iWork. I already mentioned full file compatibility across iOS, Mac, and web. The Pages has new context-sensitive format panels. So the format panel is all in one window. The inspectors and things like that are all put together. iWork was completely rewritten for the Mac. There's new collaboration features for iWork in iCloud, and those look pretty cool. You'll be able to real-time work on your documents, your iWork documents, with other users using the iCloud interface or even the device interface. So you can be working on a Mac and they can be on the web, or you can be working on iOS and they can be on the web, or iOS to iOS. It all syncs up through iCloud. And again, iWork is available right now, and it is a free upgrade for existing iWork owners, as well as you get it free with any new Mac or iOS device. So Apple really wanting to get their consumer applications out into the hands of everybody who buys a Mac or an iOS device. And as a secondary thing, Apple also did push out updates for Find My iPhone, the podcast app, and the iTunes Trailers app on iOS, basically bringing in the new clean, updated iOS 7 look and feel. So they're finally kind of bringing all of their apps into play into the space of iOS 7. The one app that didn't get a sort of a new icon and much of a new look, it got a little bit of a new look on the desktop, but still has kind of the same style icon, was GarageBand on the Mac. It still has kind of the wood trim and some of the old kind of skeuomorphic features, which is interesting. I'm not sure why Apple didn't update that interface as much as some of the others, but grab those if you if you're an owner of iWork or iLife. iPads. And then they moved on to the big event. So after about an hour, Apple started talking about the new iPads. They mentioned how well iPads have been doing. 170 million iPads sold. Those are the cumulative sales. So since Apple announced the iPad, they've sold 170 million different iPads. They also focused on that usage share number again. So they have kind of moved away from looking at market share, because we know the iPad is no longer the dominant tablet in the market. But Apple likes to focus on the fact that 81% of the tablets being seen used on the web are iPads, with just 19% being Android devices. So they infer from that that Android devices and tablet, or tablets specifically, aren't being used as frequently as iPads. And it's not too far of a stretch, because if you have a tablet, you're probably using it to surf the web. So the question would be, what are all those other tablets doing? And I have a feeling you have things where Android devices and tablets are being used as dedicated e-readers, dedicated movie devices. And so that stat doesn't take that into effect. So it's a little bit skewed, but I think the point is well made, that iPad customers seem to really use their devices a lot for a lot of different things. And I think in the case of some really specific lower priced Android tablets, they're kind of purchased to do just one thing, and really that's how they're used. And I'm guessing that's what I read into that number. I don't know if I'm right or not. That's just my harebrained theory. And they also pointed out that there's over 475,000 dedicated iPad apps. I think that actually moves into that usage score, because on Android, there tends to be more apps that are just phone apps that are kind of scaled up, and the experience isn't all that great. And when you don't have a great holistic experience, right, you don't want to mess around or use that thing too much. So you probably stick to the things it's sort of optimized and built for. And the iPad certainly has a lot of dedicated iPad apps. So Apple was refreshing the iPad line at this event. We got a new full-size iPad, although it's not called the iPad with Retina display fifth generation. They gave it a brand new name, the iPad Air, and that's to represent the fact that it's thinner, lighter, and more powerful than ever before, according to Apple. I have to say, the name took everybody aback a little bit. I was shocked when I heard it. I'm not sure how I feel about it, how much I really like it. I guess it's going to grow on me. It makes sense to a certain degree, but when you first hear iPad Air, you're like, that's kind of lame. They're just, you know, playing on the MacBook Air whole sort of thing. But it's a 9.7-inch Retina display with a much smaller bezel, matches the styling of the iPad mini like we thought, but it's 43% thinner, so significantly thinner. It's also significantly lighter. It's just 1 pound. That's down from 1.4 pounds. So it is the, Apple says, the lightest full-sized tablet in the world, although Amazon came out and kind of said, well, our new Kindle HDX tablet, which is, I think, slightly smaller, I think they use an 8.7 inch screen, theirs is a little bit lighter, I think, than Apple's iPad Air. So I'm not sure how they're figuring out what the lightest full-size tablet in the world is, but it's certainly 28% lighter, which is going to be significant. All of the early hands-on reports say that it's definitely noticeable in the hand, that it feels almost like the original iPad mini in terms of weight, which I'm super excited about, because that's about my only complaint with my third generation iPad, is that after a certain amount of usage, if you're really holding it for book reading or that sort of thing, watching movies, it does get a little bit heavy after about an hour or so, at least for me. So 20% thinner than the outgoing model at 7.5 millimeters and 28% lighter. A7 chip inside, so 64-bit. Apple pointed out that that means it's about 8 times faster than the original iPad, the first generation iPad, and 72% faster in terms of graphics performance. Really what that means, over the prior generation, the iPad fourth Retina display, fourth generation, it's about twice as fast as the previous generation. And along with the A7, it also has the M7 motion coprocessor. So basically the same processor that is in the iPhone 5S is in the new iPad Air. They have faster Wi-Fi. It has MIMO, the dual in and out dual antenna Wi-Fi system. Still 802.11n, so not 802.11ac. A lot of people want to ask why Apple didn't go with AC. My best guess is it has to do with power consumption and battery life. From the few people I know who kind of know about Wi-Fi technologies, those 802.11ac chips are more of a battery hog. They use up more energy. So it may just be that Apple went, we can add two antennas, get some faster performance on the Wi-Fi, and not have to sacrifice some of the battery life for the unit. 5-megapixel EyeSight camera. I think it's the same EyeSight camera as it had before. The FaceTime camera did get the update with the better backside illuminated sensor. Still 1.2 megapixel, 720p HD on the FaceTime camera. 10 hours of battery life on the iPad Air, and it actually has a slightly smaller battery, so that's a pretty big achievement. And also the styling, taking the cues from the iPad mini, slate and black and silver and white. No gold model on the iPads. And same pricing as before. So starting at $499 for the 16 gig, $599 and $699. And then when you jump up to the LTE models, you're starting at $629 US for the 16 gig model, $729 and $829. Oh, they also have the 128 gigabyte models, I forgot, on the full size iPad. $799 for that, and Wi-Fi, $929 for that if you want the LTE model. And again, the LTE bands are expanded, so they'll be able to support more countries and more carrier networks. Really interesting thing, and I wrote lame in my notes, but they're keeping the iPad 2 around. Not the iPad 3, not the fourth generation iPad, but the iPad 2 at $399. So if you want to get three-year-old technology for $100 less than the brand new thing, you can still get that. And you know, the question was, why would Apple do that? Why wouldn't they go with a more modern iPad? And the best guess from a number of people that I spoke with was maybe it's because of education, enterprise, and government kinds of markets who have invested maybe in the 30-pin dock connector accessories, the medical industry. There's a lot of industries that have accessories that go along with that. If you're a school, maybe all of your charging systems, your carts, a lot of the peripheral technology is tied up in that 30-pin dock connector. And so then I thought, well, why not go with the iPad 3, the third generation iPad, which has the 30-pin connector. So you'd think that'd be a better choice. Rene Ritchie reminded me and pointed out that the third generation iPad, in terms of performance, actually runs a little bit slower than the iPad 2 because it's got the Retina display. So the processor and everything, the whole system is being taxed a little bit more. So in terms of just performance, the iPad 2, even though it's not Retina, has a little bit better performance. And again, that may factor into those vertical markets. So that could be why I'm not entirely certain what's going on. But as far as the new iPad, the iPad Air, it is available. It will be shipping in on November 1st, or you can order it from Apple's online store November 1st, or pick it up in an Apple retail store on November 1st. No pre-orders again. So darn you, Apple. I don't know if I'm going to actually camp out for this one or just press my luck and hope that they're in store. I don't expect that there will be supply shortages of the iPad Air. I think it should be in pretty good availability from everything that we're hearing. So I'm not worried about it too much, but I may swing by my Apple retail store early in the wee morning of November 1st just to make sure that I can get my new iPad Air, because I definitely want one. I skipped the fourth generation iPad and was planning to upgrade to this one. So that will replace my iPad third generation. I'm also super excited about the other iPad that they announced, the iPad Mini, and as I expected, I know some people doubted it, it does have the Retina display. I don't think Apple could have put it out without the Retina display. So 2048 by 1536 pixels, that's the same pixel resolution as the full-size iPad Air. That means at the smaller size, it's going to have a much tighter pixel density. So it should look beautiful. The screen should be gorgeous. And actually, from the hands-on reports that we've been getting, it does look awesome. A7 processor in the iPad Mini, too. That was a shock to me. I did not expect Apple to go with the A7 64-bit processor in the iPad Mini. So you're looking at 4 times faster CPU performance, 8 times faster graphics performance. You also get the M7 Motion coprocessor. It is a little bit thicker and heavier, just minutely thicker and heavier than the prior generation iPad Mini. I'm guessing that's because they had to cram in more battery. They had to put in that display, which is a little bit thicker. Same thing happened when Apple went to Retina on the full-size iPad. So I think that was to be expected, and Apple did a pretty good job of keeping those stats down to a minimum. 10-hour of battery life, twice as fast Wi-Fi, so it's using the MIMO Wi-Fi, the dual antenna, dual in and out Wi-Fi, or multiple in, multiple out Wi-Fi. I think that's what MIMO stands for on the iPad Mini, along with the expanded LTE support. Pricing again remains the same, starting at $399 for the Wi-Fi models, $529 for the LTE versions, and going up $100 for each storage option there. Up to 128 gigabytes on the iPad Mini with Retina display. They also are keeping around the old iPad Mini without the Retina display and dropping the price on that about $30 down to $299 US. And those are available now. The iPad Mini with Retina display, they just said sometime later in November. They didn't give us a hard date. They didn't say late in November, just later, meaning I assume sometime after they bring out the iPad Air on November 1st. So we'll be chomping at the bit to figure out when we can get our new iPad Minis. I am in a quandary about that one. I love my iPad Mini. It's actually my preferred form factor for an iPad. It's the one that I grab most frequently. I would love to have a Retina display, but if you notice, the one major thing that wasn't there on both of these iPads, it's the Touch ID. And I've fallen in love with Touch ID on my iPhone 5S. I'm actually addicted to it. I've become so conditioned that I often try and unlock my iPads by using a Touch ID that isn't there. So I was really hoping these devices would have Touch ID. I do want at least one new iPad. I'd love to have them both, but it starts to get really pricey when you're looking at 32 or 64 gigabyte models. That's a lot of cash coming out of your bank account. So I don't know what I'm going to do yet. I'm going to try and get some cash for my old iPad, my third generation iPad. So hopefully that'll take away some of the sting, but we'll see. I'm so addicted. I probably will pick up an iPad Mini, a new iPad Mini as well. It's just too cool to avoid. But I'm, as you can tell, very excited about Apple's new iPad models, and I think they're going to do very well moving into the holiday season. I'd love to hear all of your thoughts on any of this stuff that we've talked about, of course, so please send in your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Love to know, you know, if you thought this was a big deal. Some people think that, you know, maybe this isn't enough. Maybe Apple needed to do a little bit more to kind of juice the market, especially in terms of pricing. I think the most critical thing that's coming across is pricing on this stuff is really premium, but Apple's always been about their margins and being the premium priced product. So I think they're keeping some of the older models around to kind of compete. I don't know that the savvy consumer is really going to be fooled, especially by an iPad 2 at $399. I think that wasn't the best move for Apple there. Again, questioning it, thinking the only possible reason could be the vertical market. And, you know, for consumers, maybe there's a few consumers that might be interested in that. I don't really know. Sorry to keep harping on that, but it's just confusing to me. There's also some new smart covers, $39 US for smart cover, a couple new colors, I believe. And then also smart cases, which are like the smart cover, but with a back covering. I think some people were reporting that that was new. Actually, the smart cases have been around since 2012. I think Apple brought those out. I don't know how popular they've been, but they are available as an option if you want a case from Apple that's full a full wrap. I already mentioned the major thing that wasn't there on the iPads, Touch ID. A couple of other things that weren't there in the announcement. iPads don't get the burst or slow motion video that the iPhone 5S does. So that's interesting because I would have thought that feature would have been related to the GPU and the image processor that chip that's in the device. And I would expect those to be the same since Apple went with the A7 processor in both those models. So maybe it's more related to the actual sensor that's in there. And since it didn't get the updated 8 megapixel sensor like on the iPhone 5S, you don't have those modes in there. There was also no Apple TV updates. I know some people were curious about that or disappointed by that. That didn't shock me whatsoever. I didn't expect Apple to update the Apple TV, mainly because I don't know what you'd add to the current generation Apple TV to make it all that better, at least in terms of the hardware. I think Apple's going to have to go to a radical new sort of Apple TV concept. You know, it sounds like I'm alluding to an actual Apple television. That may be the thing that they're looking to do in the future. You know, the only other thing I could think they could do would be to add DVR type functionality, sort of recording functionality. I know a lot of people would really like that, but I just don't think that is what Apple's looking to do in terms of changing the television ecosystem. I think they want to move in a completely different direction that's sort of been done and been out there for a while, and Apple doesn't want to repeat that technology. Just my opinion. So I think that we're stuck with kind of the Apple TV in the current form factor until Apple can really shake up the television system. So I don't even expect an update anytime in 2014, maybe the end of 2014 if Apple does something, but I think there's a lot of things that have to come into play for that to take off. Apple didn't update their displays. I thought that with the Mac Pro coming out, we might see a new Thunderbolt 4K display, but Apple didn't announce anything there. I have a feeling we could see that maybe sometime next year, an update, but it looks like Apple's relying on third-party vendors to provide those 4K displays for the new Mac Pro owners. You're not going to be able to buy one from Apple, at least, I don't think, this year. So some interesting things weren't in the announcements just as much as were in the announcements at the event. And then right after the event, there was an update to iOS. iOS 7.0.3 came out. It addresses a number of issues and adds some key new functionality. A big one is that it adds iCloud keychain support. That was something that was in iOS 7. It was also in Mavericks, and it was pulled right before the last few builds of iOS before it was released last month. Everybody expected it to come back when Apple announced Mavericks. Now that Mavericks is out, it's got iCloud keychain. You need that on iOS, so we get an update on the iOS side. It also added a password generator related to iCloud keychain to Safari. So Safari, when you're registering on a site now on your mobile device, can now suggest a harder to guess password for you and put that into your iCloud keychain. It reportedly fixes that iMessage bug that was affecting a number of people. I actually got hit by that a couple times where you go to send an iMessage and it just literally wouldn't send or you wouldn't receive an iMessage. It fixes the accelerometer calibration issue on the iPhone 5S. So SensorGate is reportedly over. Those have never been 100% accurate, I don't think, but the level is more level and the compass is more accurate in with the iOS 7.03 3 update, or at least it's more in line with the older devices, the iPhone 5 and 4S and stuff like that. So they should all calibrate the same now. So that and a bunch of other really cool fixes in there. Oh, another big, huge one. It fixes or enhances the reduce motion setting. So we talked about some people with the parallax effect and all the motion effects were actually getting motion sickness from iOS 7 or reportedly getting motion sickness from iOS 7. If you went into accessibility, you could turn on a toggle switch to reduce the motion, but really it just got rid of the parallax effect. It didn't change the zooming in and zooming out. Now when you enable it under iOS 7.0.3, it actually changes the transitions so you no longer have the zooming. You get just simple fades. It actually, in my opinion, makes the interface feel like it's responding even faster because I think those animations are a little bit slow. So I actually am probably going to run that full-time on my system, even though I don't suffer from sort of the motion sickness stuff. So a lot of good updates in the iOS 7.0.3 update. So you want to grab that one if you've been running iOS 7. It is available through the over-the-air update or just hook up to iTunes and run your software update on your devices. And that was pretty much everything from the announcements. I want to get into some of the feedback and some additional comments, some tips and tricks for Mavericks and some of the other new apps that were announced. But before we get into that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that's Smile. I tell you all the time about their great apps like Text Expander and PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, Disc Label, Text Expander Touch. They actually have a new application out now called PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. And this is really cool. It's like having a scanner, a document scanner in your pocket because you can run the software and then use your camera on your iOS device to actually make scans of documents. So you just take a picture of your document. It's super easy. It creates a high quality document scan right on your iOS device. And it's really easy to use. You can get the images in fast and they look great. You shoot the picture with your camera. You can also import it from your camera roll or even import files from your favorite cloud storage services. It then quickly analyzes that image. It automatically crops, sizes it for standard paper sizes, and even visually enhances it so that it has better legibility, which you want if you're doing a scan. And you can also go in and tweak and manually adjust those settings to get the absolute best quality and then save that in color, grayscale, or text mode. So if you just want the black and white text, you can just get that out of it pretty easily. The whole process, sort of stepping through it, I think is perfect. It is one of the best scanning applications for iOS that I've used. And now you can have that high-quality scan on your device in PDF format. And because it's PDF, you can do lots of stuff with it, like send it to PDF Pen on your iOS device for further editing. You can email it. You can print it. You can put it up into iCloud. It has iCloud integration. You can open it in other applications or send it to Dropbox, Evernote, Box, Alfresco, Google Drive. It has support for all of your favorite cloud storage services, as well as you can export to iTunes, put it on an FTP server, put it on a web dev server. So a great way to get scans with your iOS device on the go and then get them off to other places. And that alone would be totally awesome, right? That's all the app needs to do, but that's not even the best part. The best part is Scan Plus also OCRs your document. You can hit the OCR button. It will highlight everything as it goes down the document and it's doing its scan, so you can kind of in real time see what it's OCRing. And then when it's done, it embeds the OCR data into your PDF, making the PDF searchable. Plus, you can tap a button and copy the OCR text and paste it into other applications' emails. It's just super handy and super cool. And it's still introductory price right now, $4.99. So go grab it on the App Store right now. And be sure to head over to smilesoftware.com and check out all the other stuff that Smile makes. I love everything they make. Text Expander, PDF Pen, PDF Pen Pro, PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, Text Expander Touch, and now PDF Scan Plus. Really cool stuff. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. Let's talk about Mavericks Fever, because you know we all have it, right? I want to install Mavericks on my main Mac so bad right now. I am chomping at the bit to get at the new features, especially, as I mentioned earlier, the full screen, multiple display stuff. But MacCast friend, active community member John Foster wrote me an email, reminded me, he talked me down off the ledge, gave me his sagely advice that he always does, that, you know, some of us need to take a pause. You get caught up in the hype and everybody's upgrading and your friends and your neighbors got the cool new operating system and you want to play in that sandbox too. But we all also, a lot of us have real work that we need to get done on these existing systems. We can't deal with any hiccups. You might be in the middle of a project. You might have some critical things that you need to do. And it's really easy to get caught up in that wave and just dive in and leap and go for it. You know, hey, everybody's saying it's okay. Everything's running okay. And that's what we're hearing. And that little niggling in your ear, you know, that's tempting, right? That's like, oh, it'll be fine. It'll be fine until you do it. And then you realize that something mission critical isn't working and you can't get your job done and you waste hours, if not days, trying to get things back and restored. And it looks really bad to go to a client or a customer and say, oh, yeah, I couldn't finish your project because I upgraded my operating system right in the middle of this thing. So, you know, that free price is also a new thing that makes it very, very tempting. And I think John tweeted out, you know, free does not mean free of problems all of the time. Every major OS update that's released, there's potentially some bugs, some that we already know about at this point. Some people are experiencing some issues and some things that might break that could affect your ability to do your work. So you might have apps that are not up to date, critical apps that didn't get updated or have problems under Mavericks. You might have drivers for your hardware devices, your printers, your scanners, other connected devices that suddenly stop working because you upgraded. You might have another one that isn't often thought about. You might have software that you update, but the file format is tweaked. So now you can only update that file or use that file on the current version of the software. And maybe that person that you're exchanging those files with, the printer you're sending it to, isn't updating. And they suddenly can't work with or use your files. I mean, that's a big deal. So you might consider, if you're in that kind of situation, waiting for a lot of the fallout, for a lot of the reports to come out, for those people who are early adopters to figure out where the bumps and hiccups are, and wait for that stuff to get smoothed out before you jump in as John calls it, OS X Sea Lion, which I love. I absolutely love that. You know, get it, Mavericks, the ocean, and then it was in the lion cat family, so Sea Lion. Yeah, I think that's very good. I thought that was very clever. I might even start calling it that myself. But, you know, if you have to play with Mavericks and you're in the situation where you have mission-critical stuff, you might consider using another Mac that's not so mission critical. A lot of us have multiple Macs. That's what I'm doing. I have a MacBook Air that I use less frequently. You know, all my production work's done on my 15-inch MacBook Pro, so I'm going to hold off on that one, play around with Mavericks, get used to it, find out where those hiccups are on that system, and then I can deal with those at my leisure, and I'm not going to be putting myself out of work or in some sort of downtime while I try and resolve issues. Another idea could be you could use an external drive, clone your existing operating system over to a bootable drive and then upgrade that and switch back and forth. So you can switch over at night, play around with Mavericks, have all your kind of fun, and then during the day, switch back and work on your production system. So that's another way to go about that. But just, you know, a word of caution, we don't all have to upgrade to the latest and greatest thing right away. And frankly, some of us probably shouldn't. But if you are going to upgrade, something that you probably want to do is make a bootable USB stick in case you have an emergency down the road. Of course, Apple installs that bootable recovery partition or creates that bootable recovery partition. But what if your hard drive fails? What if you need to get back up and running and you want to try and run Disk Utility or reinstall the operating system? Well, because you download directly from the Mac App Store, it's not super easy to make a recovery disk. Now, Apple does have a piece of software that they made available for Mountain Lion and Lion called the OS X Recovery Disk Assistant that will let you create a bootable USB stick. I'm not certain that's supported in Mavericks yet. I haven't personally tried it. If you happen to know, or if you tried it out and you were able to make a bootable disk with Mavericks using that tool, let us know. But Apple had not at the time I was recording this, updated their tech info article on the support site to say that it was supporting Mavericks. So I did find a trick and tried it out. It worked for me. I found this actually over on Lifehacker. I'll have a link to the full instructions in the show notes at mattkast.com. But basically, you need at least an 8 gigabyte USB stick, and you need to feel comfortable running a terminal command. So it's certainly not for the faint of heart. Also, I'll give you the caveat, anytime you're running anything in the terminal, especially with this, because you're giving it paths to volumes, and I believe that the volume might get erased when you actually run the command. If you mess that up, you could potentially erase one of your hard drives. So you need to be careful about the command you run. Make sure you have backups if you're going to try this, but it's pretty straightforward if you're, you know, moderate to advanced kind of user and comfortable with the terminal. I think you'll understand what's going on here. But first, you need to download OS X Mavericks from the Mac App Store. So go to the Mac App Store, click on the upgrade button. It will download the file and launch the installer. Don't run the installer. Quit the installer, and it will leave a file in your applications folder called installOS10Mavericks.app. So you want to see that file there. Once that's there, then you're going to get your USB stick. You're going to format it with Disk Utility as Mac OS X Extended Journaled. Give it a name, Untitled. Give it the name Untitled, and this is important, with a capital U, Untitled, and format the drive. You need to give it that exact name because that's the name that the script is going to use when you run it in the terminal. If you give it a different name, you're going to need to tweak the script with the exact name that you gave that USB drive. So once you've done that, you launch terminal and you'll copy and paste the command from the Lifehacker link, again, in the show notes at mattkast.com. But basically what it does is it runs a command called create install media in the terminal, and it does that on your formatted USB stick, and it'll copy over the installer stuff from the downloaded Mavericks, install OS10Mavericks.app file, and create your bootable disk. It takes about 20 minutes, and you don't get a lot of feedback in the terminal as it's running, so you just kind of got to kick it off and let it sit there for about 20, 30 minutes or so until it says done on the screen in the terminal. Then the disk should be ready to go. You can eject it and verify it worked by holding down the option key while booting your Mac, and it should boot from the install disk if it worked. There was an older method of creating a bootable disk for Mountain Lion where you would actually open up the installer package in the applications folder and copy out the ESD, the electronic software distribution image. That doesn't seem to work anymore. That file is actually not in the package contents of the Mavericks package, so, or the Mavericks app installer. I actually went and looked for it and didn't find it there. So you're going to want to use this new method, and that's how I was able to actually make a bootable OS X Mavericks USB key. So we already mentioned earlier that iLife and iWork apps, both on Mac and iOS, were completely updated, and that the Mac applications are free updates for existing owners and anybody who buys a new Mac. And all of those updates are done via the App Store application, but it has caused a little bit of confusion, especially if you were a customer who purchased the iLife and or iWorks DVD copies. If you installed them manually from DVD, which I was actually in that camp, at least initially, some of those updates weren't showing up in the App Store. That is supposedly fixed right now, but if you're not seeing it, I thought I might run through some of the tricks and some of the issues people have been having. So most people who bought directly from the Mac App Store, they just showed up for you. You just run the update and there they are. Some people are still reporting having trouble, even though Apple reportedly fixed the issues. John Martellaro from the Mac Observer actually mentioned to me that he couldn't see the updates in his main user account, but when he logged out of his Mac and logged in using a different admin user account on the same Mac and then went to the Mac App Store application under that account using the same iTunes Apple ID as he did with his main, you know, with his own account, the updates showed up and he was able to install them and then switch back to his main account. And, you know, once they're installed on the system using an admin account, they should run just fine. So that might be a trick you can try if, you know, you're still not seeing those updates, but you should see them now. I will mention that to see a number of them, you do need to be running Mavericks. I'm still running Mountain Lion, as I said, on my 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I'm not seeing all of the updated versions of the applications. What's interesting is that when I go into app updates, I can see OS X Mavericks, and then I can see down at the bottom of my update window, there's a little link that says show incompatible app updates. And when I click on that, it expands open and I see iPhoto and iMovie. I don't see GarageBand, although if I search the App Store, I can see the GarageBand update and it does appear to be free, but I don't see any of the iWork applications. I tried, after upgrading my MacBook Air to OS X Mavericks, doing the same thing, and I saw all of the updates, all of the iWork updates, all of the iLife updates, except for GarageBand, on that system and was able to update everything. So it does look like you pretty much need to be running Mavericks to see, at the very least, the iWork updates. And for me, whatever reason, I had to like manually go find GarageBand in the App Store and install that, although it was a free install. Something cool that Apple is doing with the iWork installers under OS X Mavericks is that if you already had iWork 09 installed, it seems to move those into their own folder, iWork 09 folder, and keep them around. So it installs the new versions in your applications folder, but the old ones are still there. So if you need to use the old versions or you're not happy with the interface changes on the new one, you can flip back and forth. The only caveat there is it appears that, at least in Pages, I haven't tried the other applications, but I would assume they're the same. When you open a file or create a new file in the new version, it's in a new format, and you cannot open that in the old version of the application, the Pages 09 version, for example. There is an export to Pages 09 in the new version, so you can get back that way, but just be aware of that. If you're converting your apps in the new version and you're moving back and forth, it's going to be a little bit of a trickier process to jump back and forth using the same documents. It was also noted that on the iOS versions, because there's that feature compatibility, if you open those files on iOS, it'll give you a warning that it is going to convert them. There is no export back to Pages 09 versions on your iOS device. So if you're going to do that, you're not going to be able to share those documents with someone who has an older version of the iOS version of Pages. That you're going to have to bring them over to the Mac and re-export them back. You cannot export them to an old version, as near as I can tell, on the iOS version. Overall, in terms of the iLife iWork apps, I'm not sure how I feel about the new icons, the app icons. At first, I thought they were really ugly. They're kind of growing on me a little bit, but I'm still not quite used to them yet. I kind of like the older icons better. The other thing I want to comment on in general, especially with the iWork application, is that Apple made this huge statement, this big deal, that it's got full feature parity across all the different platforms, desktop to iOS to web. And if that were completely true, that's a huge, huge achievement. I had a feeling during the keynote, as Apple was saying it, that the way they got feature parity was as much as adding new features about removing some of the features that we already had. And it's looking like that turned out to be true now that we're getting some reports. A big one that we're hearing about is AppleScript support in the iWork application. Specifically, the dictionaries that you use for AppleScript seem to have been stripped down extremely in OS X Mavericks as it relates to Pages, and are non-existent for Numbers. I'm not sure about Keynote. I haven't seen anybody comment on the AppleScript for Keynote, but all that stuff seems to be really crippled in OS X Mavericks. And the bummer here is that this is at the OS level. So that even means that while you have the 09 versions of those apps still in Mavericks after you do the upgrade, the AppleScript libraries aren't there. So if you rely on iWork workflows in AppleScript, you probably want to avoid upgrading to Mavericks and upgrading to the new iWork versions of the apps. So just be aware of that. Now I want to comment specifically on some of the individual applications. I'm not going to hit all of them, just some of the highlights of things that I've read about or heard about with relation to some of the new applications. I'm going to start with iMovie, both for iOS and for the Mac. Really cool new features on iOS. adds some really nice functionality, including the ability to do split screens and picture-in-picture. You also finally get the slow motion controls. So if you're a new iPhone 5S owner, you're going to be able to control the speed of those clips. So those great 120 frame per second clips that you pull in, you can now slow them down, speed them up, and do all that control right inside iOS. You don't have to export out to iMovie on the Mac. There's all new audio controls, a lot more control over audio to do editing as well as duplicating audio clips. You can even replace audio from one clip and add it to another, and a lot more things on the audio side. So that's been greatly expanded in iMovie on iOS. And I already mentioned the sharing. There's this new feature called iCloud Movie Theater that allows you to take your projects and go into a mode where you can kind of view them. It almost looks a lot to me like the Apple TV interface or even the trailers interface. So you can see your video there, you can play it, and all of that syncs up through iCloud. So you have an iMovie Theater app on the Apple TV now, and you can pull that up and you can see all of the stuff that you created with iMovie on your iOS devices as well as your Mac. Now, iMovie on the Mac is even more expanded in terms of new features. It has a new look, but also some killer new features in there. Color matching between different clips. You can do color adjustments in terms of highlights and shadows, even the color temperature. Improved stabilization. So if you're a fan of that feature, I'm using that all the time because I'm a little bit shaky with my hand-holding of cameras. I prefer to actually use a tripod if I can, but when I need to do that, image stabilization is supposed to be better. You can adjust the playback speed now in the timeline, so that should be a little bit better for controlling, again, those slow-motion shots that you might shoot with your iPhone 5S. One interesting thing is we still don't have video effects back in iMovie. If you remember back in the iMovie HD days, we had all these cool things. There were third-party plugins you could do. You could do a lot more in terms of video effects. Apple still hasn't put those back in there, even though we have filters and stuff in iPhoto and iPhoto on iOS. So I'm not sure why they're not adding that stuff back into the video stuff, but it'd be nice to see that coming back to iMovie. But that's some of the new things they're doing with iMovie. iWork, just commenting in general on some of the new UI, it takes on a lot of the look and feel of the iLife applications. I already mentioned that the inspector palette in Pages is no longer in a floating window. It's kind of in this sidebar. I think some of that was done just to add interface parity between the web and iOS and the Mac. It's much easier to do it that way. I think it's also a little bit more convenient, especially if you're using multiple monitors and you're dragging windows around. It's nice to kind of have that attached to the actual document that you're working on. And it does change contextually depending upon what you're doing. So that, in my mind, almost when Apple said that feature, it felt like they were taking a cue from the ribbon in Microsoft Word. But with how it's implemented, it's not at all like that. It's just as you're sort of highlighting things and working, your little panel, your inspector panel, will kind of change over there on the left and provide you the tools that you're most likely to be wanting to work with. Of course, you can go in and select additional ones and stuff like that. But that seemed to work very well, at least when I was playing with it. I think I'm going to actually like that in terms of a new format. And talking about Pages on the Mac specifically, the fonts all seem to be there in sync between the different versions. So you do seem to have feature parity in terms of the web and also iOS. It was a little bit clunky when I was playing around with it with how it worked. I first opened a document in Pages on the Mac. I had the font in Lucida Grande, which is not something that's typically on my iOS device. So when I went to open that same document on iOS, it warned me that it didn't have the font, and it substituted Helvetica for me. And then I made some additional changes, and I was kind of moving back and forth, and eventually it seemed like the font synced over to my iOS device, and then I was able to pick it, but it wasn't there initially. So I don't know if that's just load as people are playing around with the iCloud syncing, but I do think it needs to sync over iCloud. The other thing that was interesting about the fonts is that it did seem to be document only. So even though on my iOS device it had synced over Lucida Grande font for that one document, when I went in to create a new document on iOS, I did not have that font available. So I don't know if that has to do with font licensing or something like that, but that's just something to be aware of. A lot of people wrote in to tell me about Pages on the Mac being crippled. A big feature that they rely on would be the contact merging feature. So if you do mail merge kind of stuff with contacts, apparently that's gone. I don't know if that is related to the removal of some of the AppleScript libraries, but it sounds like it might be, because I've also been reading in the reports that Mavericks in general breaks that functionality in Pages 09. So even if you go back on Mavericks to the old version that did have contact merge, it's not working or not functioning in Pages 09. So that seems to indicate that it might be related to the AppleScript stuff. And somebody also pointed out that Pages on the Mac no longer has the duplicate a page feature. So if you have the page panel opened up, you used to be able to select a page and actually duplicate it. That feature seems to be gone as well. And I'm sure there's some other things, but those are some of the first ones that I've had people point out to me or that I've noticed myself. And then the last new application, iLife application that I want to talk to you about is GarageBand. And this one is going to be a little bit of a rant for me because I'm a bit upset. Support for podcasting has been completely removed from the GarageBand application. That means no more podcast track, no more export to podcast or export options for podcast. You can't do custom audio levels. It just has preset values now, and you only seem to be able to export AAC or AIFF versions, no MP3, no custom controls. So that's really annoying. But even more annoying is the fact that there's no podcast track, because I use GarageBand, I have since the very beginning, to do the enhanced version of the MacCast. And so when you try and open an old project, if I try and open one of my enhanced projects on the new version of GarageBand, I get a message saying podcasting features are not supported in this version of GarageBand. To continue working with podcast features on the project in GarageBand, open the project in GarageBand 6.0.5 or earlier. That's the older version. Click OK to open a new copy of the project in GarageBand or cancel to return to the project chooser. And if you do open the document in the new version of GarageBand, it just strips out all of the podcast stuff. So that means that I'm going to have to not upgrade my GarageBand. I will continue to use GarageBand to produce the enhanced version of the MacCast for you as long as Apple will let me. I've already told you how I feel about Apple's podcast application. The writing seems to be on the wall. I feel that Apple is really declaring that enhanced AAC and enhanced podcasts are dead. They're really not supporting it very well. There's huge bugs in my mind in the podcast app. If you're using the Apple's podcast app, you know that the chapter titles are no longer showing up. It does still seem to support it. And even the updated podcast app with its new design has the chapters, has enhanced AAC support in there, sort of. The chapters still say chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, even though I put the metadata in there. If you open that in another application, say Instacast or Podcaster or Downcast, you will see all of that data and information is in there. It's just not being supported by Apple. And I really think this is Apple saying, hey, we're not doing podcasts at least in our custom format anymore. We're just going to, you know, let you use MP3. Although, like I said, GarageBand doesn't even seem to be able to export an MP3 file, at least as far as I can tell. And so that means the workflow is a little more complicated. You're going to have to export as AAC or AIFF, bring it into iTunes, and then export from iTunes the MP3 format. So it really kind of breaks the whole podcasting production workflow for me. And this goes back to what I was mentioning earlier about maybe not upgrading right away to all the latest and greatest versions. I think some people are upgrading to GarageBand podcasters and finding out all my podcast stuff is broken now. What am I going to do? And luckily, they do leave those old versions around, so you can go back and use the older version. So it's not that egregious. But, you know, these are the kinds of things that you need to think about before you just willy-nilly start upgrading stuff, even though it's fun and exciting to get the new versions of all this stuff. And I did notice when I was doing the export that there does seem to be a small bug. I was exporting to an AAC file, and the little dialogue that popped up would only be on top of all my windows. So I couldn't really export in the background because I'd go over to the Finder and the GarageBand export dialog be sitting there on top of everything I was trying to work on. So that was a little bit inconvenient. You could move it around and push it off to the side, but I don't remember it working like that before. So I think that might be a little bit of a bug that I found. But those are just some of the things that I found initially. I haven't had a lot of time to play with it. We're just about 24 hours after Apple's announcements a little bit longer. I've played around with the apps and things like that a little bit, but because I haven't upgraded my main system to Mavericks, I haven't had a chance. So if you're finding things that you like, things that you don't like, if you have hints or tips or tricks related to Mavericks or some of the new applications, please send those along. I would really appreciate short audio comments. 2 to 3 minutes, if you can keep them down to that. I appreciate getting some of those, and we can play them on a future episode of the MacCast. So send those to maccast@gmail.com. And I guess since I'm already a little bit in my rant mode, I'm going to continue on with another rant. So if you don't like my ranting, you can maybe skip over this next part. But something else came up. Actually, a couple things came up in my mind after, you know, as I was watching the keynote. One was related to something that was shown on screen. The other one is just a general thing about the whole Apple making all this stuff free. So let me start with the little video thing. There was a video shown by Tim Cook where he was talking about how customers use their iPads in amazing and creative ways. And Apple did one of their great videos where they show people using their iPads in all kinds of really cool situations and how much benefit they get out of the platform. And he talked about how because it's integrated hardware and software, we can do this stuff better than everybody else. And it's one of those really good, feel-good videos. And at about a minute and 3 seconds in, or excuse me, an hour and 3 minutes and 43 seconds in on the keynote video, if you go to that point, I got excited because they showed one of what I thought was my favorite apps, iStopMotion for the iPad from Boinks Software, which is this great stop motion software. You can create really cool stop motion, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton style videos with this thing. And I even paused after the keynote video was posted. I went back and I went and found the exact point and I paused it and I looked at the user interface to be absolutely sure, because I know there's other stop motion software out there. Looked at the UI to confirm it was the iStopMotion app and was so excited I tweeted about it. I sent a message to my friends at Boinks and said, hey, really cool to see your app on the video. And I got a reply back from Boinks and they said, well, that's really cool, but it wasn't our app. It was a clone-alike app that borrowed very heavily, in my mind, stole elements from the user interface of iStopMotion. And as a matter of fact, as I looked at the app more closely, I actually went and downloaded it. I'm not going to give you the name of the app. I know a lot of people really want to know what it is, but I don't even want to give them credit, or I don't want, you know, them getting extra downloads because I'm talking about it, because it's really not the point of this conversation. This is more about saying that we need to hold more people accountable and really frown upon this practice where people are ripping off user interface elements. And I think Apple needs to help in this situation. So it wasn't even just that they stole from the Boinks UI. If you look at the app, they obviously stole elements from Paper by 53. They have a color picker and actually a whole in-app purchase thing that looks just like the Paper by 53 purchase workflow, as well as, you know, they stole some of their user interface elements. Also, Apple's camera app, they used some of the exact same icons. I don't think those are system level. In that case, it could be that Apple's made those available as just default system level icons, but, you know, I don't think that really is the case. And then to make this worse, so all of these things are in there in this app. Apple also at one point apparently featured this app as a featured app on the App Store, which that generates a lot of excitement and people downloading it. So they got featured, they got their own keynote video, and yet you have somebody like Boinks, who is a huge contributor to the Mac community. They're a developer, they make quality software, they've been around for a really long time, and you've got this new company coming in, and I looked at some of their other apps. If you go look at their other apps, most of it is this, you know, copyware, cloneware, whatever you want to call it. It's just a bunch of junk software sold at a lower price point. Now, I do have to mention that the stop motion application that they put together actually looks like it has some unique and innovative, I'm assuming, I haven't tried every stop motion app out there, but it has some features in it that I didn't and haven't seen in iStopMotion. But that doesn't excuse what they've done in terms of the user interface. It's one thing to have an innovative app, but you need to do your own UI as well. And with Apple being a company that has sued people over user interface theft, they've sued Microsoft, they sue Samsung over this sort of thing, for them to either knowingly or even unknowingly, if they didn't even clue into this, I'm sure they were made aware of it at some point, I'm sure there's been emails sent. I sent emails the minute that I heard about it to Apple saying, hey, this is not cool. You shouldn't be supporting this stuff. We've heard these stories for a while. These have been going on. This isn't the first time I've seen this kind of thing happen with Apple and with other apps and stuff like that. Apple, I really feel, needs to be more aggressive about trying to shut this kind of thing down. You know, you could argue that it's not Apple's place to do it, that it's up to the app developer to protect their own user interface, and that I can't use the comparison of Apple suing, say, Samsung over UI, because that's Apple protecting their UI. Developers need to protect their user interface. But overall, I think there's a principle and an ethic here, and also Apple has thrown themselves out there as a company who really cares about that sort of stuff, and you would think they would want to extend that ethic and that sort of behavior across all aspects of their business. And so the App Store is a big visual thing, big visual part of their business, and they should really discourage third-party developers from engaging in that kind of behavior, the kind of behavior that Apple doesn't like. And one way to do that is make sure that when their apps show up on the App Store and they're just blatantly copying user interface elements from other apps, they should be pulled. They should not be there on the App Store. And they certainly shouldn't be featured in videos in a keynote or featured apps on the App Store. And, you know, a long time ago, I expressed concerns that with the popularity of iOS and the App Store and stuff like that, that this really had the potential to become our version of the Windows application marketplace of the 90s, where you have so many devices out there, you have so many people that want to develop, that you get these really seedy companies who just churn out a bunch of apps that are copies or reverse engineered, or it's just garbageware. And now that there's billions of apps out there, I think we're getting to that point really fast. And it's just really sad to see that come to fruition. It's really frustrating. And this week was a visual example of something. And it affected a company that I really like and respect. And it's terrible. And it wasn't fun to see. So I think all of us need to speak out more against this. I'm going to be doing it a little bit more. I posted something on Google+, as well as Facebook, pointing to this, and hopefully it gets a little buzz and it gets the conversation going. But this is just not acceptable, and I'm hoping that Apple jumps in as really a champion to make sure that, you know, developers aren't engaging in this kind of behavior, and that they really use that curation that they have of the App Store. I think that's a big, powerful part of the Mac App Store, the App Store, and the Mac App Store versus some of the other app stores that Apple's competitors are doing, something that they can use for really in a really good way to help protect developers and really encourage the developers who are doing things right to make apps and discourage the guys that are just throwing out junkware and copying and doing all that stuff, and get them out of there and off there. Let them go over to those other stores that aren't curated. And that's why we have curation. Apple needs to, I think, be more aggressive about it. I think they're getting a little bit caught up in just having the huge numbers of applications. And I think we need to focus back on quality. I think we've lost that just a little bit. There's still quality stuff in there, but, you know, we need to make sure that rises to the top, not this junk. All right. So there's that. There's that rant. The next rant is a little bit of a less of a rant. It's more on the lines of my new app world order conversation, and it's just, you know, Apple made all of their software, the big thing, one of the big things coming out of this keynote, is they made everything free. OS 10 Mavericks is free, so OS updates are presumably going to be free going forward. Really high quality productivity apps are free from Apple, so you get the iWork suite, which is amazing, all for free. All the great iLife applications. And so this really kind of makes it hard for whole categories of competitors to compete. I don't think that's that big of an issue. There's a lot of opportunity on the Mac App Store and with iOS devices and the Mac to make money. So, you know, it's going to be a little bit harder, I think, to make a word processor application, but I think there's still room to improve over Pages. And I think there's still going to be some great apps out there. But beyond that, you know, free is awesome for us. It's awesome for consumers. I love getting high quality apps for free. And Apple can do it because they make money elsewhere. They make it on hardware. They make it on other products and services like iCloud, those sorts of things. So that's easy for them to do. It's awesome for Apple because it gets them great exposure. It makes customers happy. We like our products. We can do really great things with our products. So good for consumers, good for Apple. I do have a concern that if you're a developer, it might not be so good. And not just in terms of it makes it harder for you to compete with Apple's high-quality free application. I think it gives consumers this impression that they're supposed to get really high-quality software for free. Savvy consumers understand the ecosystem. They understand how it works. They understand that Apple's making money in other ways. But not every consumer is going to understand that. And having been a person who's a web developer and dealt with stuff on the web, I suffer from the same thing. Podcasts are expected to be free by most consumers. You have to find ways to make money in other ways. And we're seeing that on the app ecosystem. The old models are quickly becoming unsustainable, in my opinion, because of this free race to the bottom kind of pricing. So you would say then, well, then that's okay, right? Developers need to find and adopt new models. And we're seeing that. The thing is I'm not really, again, I'm fully maybe admitting I'm an old fogey here. I don't like a lot of the new models. They don't appeal to me, but maybe they're appealing to a broader consumer. Adware. Ads in free apps, freemium apps, subscription models. And these are all fine, and I think they work very well, but they can also be done in a good way and a bad way. I think we're starting to see more and more the bad way show up, and maybe this relates to the other conversation I was having earlier about just more is not always better, and we're seeing developers have to really compete for every nickel and dime, and it's leading to some really aggressive schemes for sort of making money. So you get freemium software that is really crippled, and you know it's not really free. You get nothing for free, or you get one tiny feature, and then you're immediately asked to pay and pay and pay and pay. Or you get adware where the ads are just all over the place or in your face, or you end up with interstitials. So you running the app, and then right in the middle of your gameplay, you get a big giant ad, and you've got to wait and pause, and you're forced to watch that thing. Or, hey, you know, click on this ad so you can get more free in-game money. And the more ads you watch, the more money and stuff you get. So it then at that point in my mind, it's completely defeating the purpose of the game. You know, the game becomes, how do I get money from you? And then you also have the subscription model, which is what we're seeing Adobe do with Photoshop. And, you know, that's, hey, you're going to pay every year, and you're going to have to pay every year, or Microsoft subscription service or something like that. And I really don't like that model. I haven't supported it. I haven't bought a new version of Photoshop. I'm finding alternatives that I can just pay for and buy outright. So I like the old way, and I don't like the new ones. So time will tell if this is the thing, but you know, the new app order right now in my mind seems to be catering more to the one-hit wonder application. The guy who can build something really awesome and then sell it out, and then it just sort of fades away because the new person who buys it doesn't really do anything with it. Or maybe the part-time game garage developer, which is great. That's great for the guy that just wants to work part-time. But we've got a bunch of developers who really, this is their passion. They want to just build great apps, and they want to be able to make a living off of it. And I worry that we're taking that opportunity away from them in some ways. And then you have this whole ecosystem that is just built for the ripoff developer, and that's being supported. And so I just question, is this really what we want for our app ecosystem? And if you doubt what I'm saying, seriously, take some time and reach out, talk to some of the more successful developers and have a conversation with them. If you see them at Macworld, if you happen to, you know, go to a local meetup and there's some developers there, talk to them about how they feel about these new models and the new system. And I think you'll find that a lot of them are concerned too. I don't think, it's not bleak. I'm not trying to paint this bleak picture. I think there's a lot of opportunities, and maybe we'll figure this stuff out. But it's really scary when you look at some of the directions things are going in. And then you see Apple really supporting, hey, free is the way to sell software. And they're a leader, right? They're a leader in this thing. It sort of sets a tone. And I do worry about that a little bit. I don't think it's grim. I don't think this is doomsday, but I'm just saying I'm concerned, and I'm curious what you think. Are you concerned too, or am I just way off base here? I'd love to get some feedback. Okay, enough of that. Let's finish up with some tips and some hints and maybe some fixes for some issues that you might be having with Mavericks and some of the new software and stuff like that. So one of the key new features I already mentioned earlier about Mavericks is and the iOS 7.0.3 update is that it brings along iCloud Keychain. So this allows you to save passwords into a single keychain that syncs across all your devices so that it makes logging into your favorite websites and things much, much easier. It also has a new feature that will allow you to auto-generate a secure password and automatically add it to your keychain. And this feature came in iOS 7.0.3. So if you're on a registration page on a website, you can tap on the password field and Safari will pop up a little message saying, hey, do you want me to suggest a password for you? There's also a little suggest password link at the top of the keyboard if you're on a password field. With Safari, there's no way to actually control the formula. It just gives you a certain length password and in a certain sort of formula, and then allows you to use that as the suggested password, save it into your keychain. And so I was kind of curious about this feature. I wanted to play around with it a little bit. So I tried using it on Google to sign up for, say, a Google account, and I immediately got a message on Safari on my iOS device that said, Safari will not suggest a password because Google.com requested passwords not be saved. So I couldn't use the feature, which I thought was odd. I tried it on a couple other websites and was able to use it just fine. So apparently there's some way for a web developer to block a site's ability to use the auto-generate password. And I wasn't aware of this, so I did a little bit of researching, and it looks like it's maybe more related to a feature that allows developers to block the auto-fill-in form options for form fields. And so one listener tweeted me and said, well, you can get around that if you go into Settings, Safari, and you go into the Password and Autofill option, there's a little toggle box that says Always Allow. If you toggle that to On, it supposedly can fix this issue. So if you've run into that, you might try it. Basically, it allows autofill to work even for websites that have requested that passwords not be saved. I tried this again on the Google site, and it didn't seem to restore the functionality. So I'm not sure why it didn't work for me, but you might give that a try. And as a matter of fact, Apple even has a troubleshooting iCloud keychain support article. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, just in case you run into any other problems with this feature. There might be some ideas for you in there. But there was an entry titled, I get a message saying that Safari will not save the password on one of the websites I'm using. And the fix, it offers fixes for both OS 10 or iOS, 7.0.3 and 10.9 Mavericks. And it is going into the settings and changing that little autofill always allow setting. On Mavericks, if you want to get to that setting, it's in the Safari preferences. You click on password and you select the allow autofill even for websites that request passwords not to be saved. And it does require you to set a screen lock for your Mac in order to use that feature. So I guess that option won't be available on the Mac if you're not using screen lock. So just be aware of that. So try that if you've run into that issue. If you've been playing around with iCloud Keychain and you discover any other cool tips or information, let us know about it. Another cool new addition in Mavericks, and I have to give a tip of the hat to Jim Tanis over at Tech Review, who found this actually through a tip tweeted out by Dan Frakes over at Macworld. You remember when OS X Lion came out and we lost the ability to have the home library folder in the sidebar, or if you go into your home folder, you don't see the library folder anymore, and you'd have to use that trick in the Finder, go under the Go menu, holding down the Option key, and then you could see the library and bring that folder up. Well, apparently, you can now toggle it back on very easily in OS X Mavericks Finder. If you just go in the Finder, go under the View menu, and choose Show View Options, Command-J is the keyboard shortcut for that. At the bottom of the window now, there's a new little checkbox that says Show Library Folder. So, you know, when you're in your home folder, use the Show View Options and turn on the Show Library Folder option. Once you check it, the library folder will reappear in all of your Finder windows. Just note that if you're using the Go menu, you still have to use the Option key to see it there. So it won't show up in the drop-down list, but it will be there in the Finder, so you can toggle it back on. So that'll save a lot of time for a lot of people and a lot of terminal hacking, which is how you could get it back before. And then the last tip I have for you is actually one for my favorite, you know, one of my favorite sponsors, Smile Software. I told you I use all their apps. I actually love all the Smile apps. And a big one for me is Text Expander. I talk about it all the time. I use it on a daily basis. But one thing Text Expander needs to do to be able to run is it relies on something in Universal Access, the Access to Assistive Devices option. That needs to be turned on. So when I upgraded to Mavericks, and Text Expander launched, it popped up a message saying, hey, you need to enable this, turn this on in your system preferences. And prior to Mavericks, this was controlled in the accessibility system preferences pane. And when Text Expander popped that up, it gave me a link and it went to that control panel. The problem is that in Mavericks, the setting moved. So the control panel that opens up is not in, it doesn't take you to the right place, which was really confusing for me. I had to Google to find the solution for this. So if you've run into this and can't figure out how to get Text Expander re-enabled in Mavericks, here's how you do it. It's in the system preferences still, but now it's under the security and privacy settings. And when you're in there, you'll need to choose the accessibility option from the list. And then you should see Text Expander listed in the little panel there on the right. And you'll need to check it on to give it access to the accessibility features. If it's grayed out, you may need to click on the little lock icon and enter your admin account username and password to be able to allow you to actually turn the accessibility access on, or for Text Expander. So just be aware of that. So authenticate, check it on, and you should be good to go. That's how you get Text Expander support back in OS X Mavericks. So there you have it, some tips and tricks for Mavericks. I'm sure there's a ton more. I'm just inundated with information right now. I'm trying to catch up as quickly as possible. I'm trying to run through all the OS X Mavericks tutorials and information. Actually, John Syracuse's huge, giant, over on Ars Technica review of OS X Mavericks is out. It's a multi-page tome. As a matter of fact, I just went and bought it as an iBook. You can get it on the iBook store for $4.99, I think, and it's 100 pages of Mac OS X Mavericks review. So I'm going to be diving into that. Hopefully, I'm sure there's some good tidbits in there, some things that I can learn. But if you've learned any cool stuff, please share it with us. But for now, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus, great new iOS app to do scanning, and also check out all of their other great applications over at smilesoftware.com. Transporter by Connected Data, you can get all the benefits of cloud storage, but with the control and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS, you can get $50 off your own transporter by using the discount code MC50. Get all the details over at filetransporter.com/MacCast. Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Also, be sure to check out Squarespace Commerce that makes it really easy to set up and sell your products online, be it physical or digital. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MacCast10. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please send in your emails, your tips and tricks related to Mavericks, iWork, or iLife. I look forward to getting those from you. You can send audio comments as well as emails to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-I-AM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website over at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum. And also, don't forget, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And you'll also find us on Google Plus. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus, and there's a community there. Hang out, post your comments, questions, all great places to just get help with your Macs and meet and hang out with other MacCast listeners between shows. So check all that stuff out, but that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.